We know what you're thinking. I just want jeans that look great, feel great, and hold up. At Ariat, we've been doing some thinking too. We're thinking about fit that moves with you, no matter where the ride takes you. Durability that stands up to hard work, harder play, and comfort that never quits. And all this thinking, it's really just about more living. Now, it's time to stop thinking and start shopping. Find your Ariat jeans at Ariat.com or a retailer near you.
These are magical moments at Monza. This did not seem possible when Charles Leclerc started fourth on the grid, but it will be a season of home victories for Charles Leclerc. The man from Monaco is the man for Monza. The Tifosi are roaring him home, and for the second time in his career, Charles Leclerc is the winner of the Italian Grand Prix for Ferrari.
Hello and welcome to the Undercut Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jesse Billington, and we're back to review the 16th race of the 2024 Formula One season, a race dominated by Ferrari pulling off a strategy against tyre degradation. It was what a bit of an odd one. It was, of course, the Italian Grand Prix, and to look back on it, I'm joined by Timo Albastelli and Ellie Mae Taylor. How are you both?
Clammy? It's really clammy weather at the minute. It's just really weird and sort of sticky and humid. It's just a bit unpleasant.
Yeah, it's got like that. Summer's technically meteorologically ended, but the weather hasn't really sort of picked up on that. I think we're due for an Indian summer, so it could be a warm September. Timo, how are you?
Still kind of riding high on all of the motorsport from the weekend. I mean, we had a heck of a good time in Monza across all three F series, if I could call them that, but then we had a pretty damn good doubleheader in IndyCar, which I'm still recovering from. And then we had NASCAR, the last race before the playoffs. And naturally, there was a bit of drama there as well. So I'm just loving it at the moment. Motorsport is really kicking off in September on a good note.
Really good time to be a Ferrari fan, because, of course, AF Corsa as well over at COTA, winning with Robert Kubica in the car as well in the 499P. So fantastic time to be Ferrari. Robert Kubica finally winning with a Ferrari as well. So wonderful times all round. And it is not just the three of us this evening. We are joined by lead F1 Academy writer for Girls Across the Grid and Formula One content creator Catherine Bruce. Welcome to the podcast, and how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thank you for having me. Although if you hear me cough, it's because I partied a little bit too hard after the Ferrari win, so I'm suffering.
Understandable. I'm a little bit hoarse and deep-throated myself after a London Broncos match on Sunday, so shouted myself silly there, hence the reason why I'm a bit more Barry White than usual.
And a lot of beers.
And a lot of beers.
And you're a lightweight.
Not necessarily that, but I don't know.
Look, also,
London Broncos had nothing to do afterwards, so they all came out and joined all the fans in the bar, and then we all went to a pub around the corner, and then it was suddenly 1:30 in the morning. Anyway, we'll jump into the news from the weekend that's more Formula One relevant, not what I've been up to. And we'll kick off with the more funny news at the start of the weekend, which is, of course, the safety car crashing during Thursday's warm-up. And it was a bit of an odd one. Anyone who had sort of like the preamble on across the Thursday will have seen this. And the initial view is it looked a bit like a massive brake failure for the Aston Martin safety car, which sort of went spinning off into the gravel at Parabolica and then slammed into the Tech Pro. A second watching of it makes me think that it wasn't the brakes failing, and this was a power slide gone wrong. Obviously, they've resurfaced the track. It had new and unique levels of grip going through a variety of different sections, mostly relatively low until it had actually been rubbered in. And if you watch back the footage, you can see the front end jinx left and then right to try and get a bit of weight transfer across the car, and it just looks like a bit of a Scandi flick on entry. And unfortunately, the car just comes round. No injuries, though Bernd Meilander did look a little bit bruised afterwards. Nice guy, though. I met him at Goodwood Festival of Speed this year, and he was pretty chatty. But yeah, he wasn't the one that was power sliding the Aston Martin safety car around, so quite why we thought Parabolica was going to go a different way was beyond me. But we'll come back to Parabolica and crashes there in a second. One of the more interesting bits of news was the Renault employees at Viry Châtillon went on a strike on Friday, and this was in protest to plans to close the F1 engine program at the French site from next year. There's also a protest in the stands from employees that were visiting and enjoying the race. It was all contrived to bring a bit of attention to the situation, but equally it was balanced out at the same time to avoid hampering team activities. But this goes on amongst the sort of constant chatter of, is Renault selling up, is Alpine pulling out, who's doing what, really what the long-term future is with that team. It's still a little bit uncertain, it seems.
Yeah, nobody, including them, I think, has any idea what they're doing. And we've kind of been saying that all season, let's face it, but now it's on a much larger scale. And if you're the workers there, you kind of think, well, fair enough, because what's your alternative? You don't know what's going on, and if anyone should know what's going on, it should be the people on the inside, at least, or give them an idea of what's happening. We'll find out when we find out, but at least tell the people it's going to directly affect so that they can sort themselves out accordingly.
I'm just curious as to where makes the engine for the Alpine A424, the Le Mans hypercar. I don't know, that's a Mechachrome V6, interestingly. It's a Mechachrome V6, so it's not even an in-house engine that's going into that. So it's just for making F1 engines, Viry Châtillon. And of course, most of their work comes out of Enstone anyway. So yeah, it's an expensive thing having a plant based just in France. And then again, you're doing the thing that Ferrari sort of, or Haas has had done, which is your team split across various nations. So it's an interesting hurdle to breach. And obviously Alpine looking to try and restructure things, but we don't quite know what's going on there. One team where we do know what's going on is, of course, Mercedes. And the worst kept secret in Formula One is finally out. And Kimi Antonelli confirmed at the Mercedes team for 2025. After a short FP1 session, Mercedes announced that he would be replacing Lewis Hamilton for next year. Currently sits P6 in the Formula 2 championship, so it's sort of on the face of things a bit of an odd choice, but given his dominance through sort of junior sort of careers in karting from sort of basically his nascence until now, he's been a pretty sort of formidable talent to go up against. And yeah, when you factor in the fact that Prema have not had the best F2 season, maybe on the face of it, P6 isn't the worst.
I don't honestly watch F2 religiously, but I keep an eye on it. And I know this year, sort of not one driver has had like a really complete clean season. They can be sort of on the pace for a couple of races, get podiums, and then suddenly sort of fall off a bit. So it's hard to really determine how well these drivers are kind of going. And I think in terms of Antonelli, I know Prema hasn't particularly been having a great season either. So have we seen all of Antonelli's talent? I don't know. Obviously, if you look at his history all the way from karting and single seaters, he's been pretty much a champion in everything. So he has got pedigree. I'm just a bit worried perhaps that they're sort of pushing him into it too soon, whether he would have sort of a better time of it, of sort of being fed into it slowly, or whether he sort of will thrive in sort of the being pushed into something and having sort of, there's a lot of, I guess, expectation on him to just sort of do really well as well. So I just hope that kind of doesn't get to him. And then it does actually sort of, like I just said, he thrives from it instead.
I agree with you. I'm kind of unsure still about how I feel about it, because like you say, it's a big gamble and a lot of pressure on a very young driver, especially one where, despite driving well under the circumstances in Formula 2 this year, and considering his age, we've not seen what was promised to us in Formula 2 this year. But then is that just because, as you and I discussed with Joe, Jesse, because of all the media overhyping him and Toto going, he's the next Messiah and all this sort of thing, and everyone constantly on the hunt for the next Max Verstappen, and it's always, let's find someone younger and younger and younger, and either that's going to go really well next year, and they're going to look like kind of, I hesitate to say legend, but you know, they're going to look pretty smug about it. But if it goes wrong, they're breaking someone who's 18 years old, 19 by the end of the season, and who knows what kind of damage that will do to him, never mind professionally and all that sort of side of things, but just personally, because you are given Lewis Hamilton's seat at Mercedes, and if you don't live up to expectations immediately, what does that do to you? And then how tricky does that make things down the line? It'd be a shame to see that. But again, when you've had this much success this early on, where is the harm in taking a little extra time and making sure? But we've said that all before about it. It's kind of, you'd still be very young coming into it if you'd done a 3 this year, 2 next year, and gone straight into F1 in 26. So it really depends on how it goes and what we measure success as.
For me, I'm kind of questioning whether Mercedes are also like ready to take on a rookie. Like normally when people join Mercedes, they've been at mainly Williams, but then obviously Lewis coming from McLaren. Do they have like the patience and just the ability to not, I guess, if he underperforms to their standards, can they deal with that? Do they know how to then come back from that? Or will they end up wasting the talent that he has by putting too much pressure on him?
Especially as a championship winning team that's getting back up to that whole sort of potential. This isn't a midfield team where you can sort of expect a bit of this and that all over the place. You need both drivers, consistently in the top 10. That's the expectation. If you can't manage that, doesn't matter if it's P11 or P12, it's still no points, you know? So it's... we'll find out, I guess.
I think for me, the big ask is the fact that he's going into Mercedes. I don't think the fact that he's replacing Lewis Hamilton is weighing on his mind, or if he's clever about it.
No, but that's for us as the spectators and the fans. That's going to be weighing on how he gets judged, rather than how it necessarily impacts him.
Lewis Hamilton is one of those once-in-a-generation level talents. You can't expect every new guy that comes along to be able to follow incredibly accurately in those footsteps. It's sort of almost unreasonable to expect or demand that of someone, especially someone who has done one season in F2, one season in Freca, and before that it was things like sort of Middle East F4 and stuff like that. So you're looking at, you can't accurately portray that. The media is always going to sort of blindly sort of go for Lewis Hamilton replacement Andrea Kimi Antonelli spins out after 12 minutes in FP1. Yeah, of course. But that's what sells a headline, but it's not the whole truth. I think there's a lot more to it than is ultimately sort of immediately perceivable. I think it's going to be interesting to see how he gets on. And like you said, it's going to be interesting to see how Mercedes deals with actually bringing up a junior driver and putting them straight into a Mercedes. But at the same time, this has got a great for George Russell, because you spent a year slightly too long in a terrible Williams. You're then brought up and then put into a terrible Mercedes. And then you're sort of gone, okay, I thought I was the wunderkind. And they've gone, oh no, we found another guy that we're going to sort of do the same thing, but we're actually going to give him the Mercedes seat. So I think, great, thanks. So my limelight, my chance at actually doing it, I've now got to try and compete against your wonder boy. Perfect. It feels a bit Mark Webber.
That is the other risk as well. It could turn into a bit of a Piastri Norris situation where you think you've got it all in hand, and then before you know it, you go,
Yeah. The other half to it is that Toto Wolff won't stop chasing Verstappen. And if Red Bull keeps getting worse, that opportunity will become more and more apparent as time goes by. If you're George Russell, you're sort of going, oh, well, they're not going to get rid of their newly signed wunderkind, because that will make it look like a mistake. But if Max Verstappen becomes available, I'm the one that's on the chopping block.
Going to have to go to Carlos Sainz to go, how did you deal with this? I don't like this position that I've been put in. How did you deal with this situation? There's nowhere at Williams then.
Yeah, well, apparently flirting with James Vowles is sort of a small-time thing, and Mick Schumacher didn't do it well enough. But anyway, we'll jump into the Grand Prix itself. And of course, we ought to mention FP1, which of course saw Antonelli binning it practically immediately. On his second flying lap, he suffered a huge snap of oversteer and wasn't really able to catch the car as it started to rotate, looped round and into the Tech Pro, pretty much where the safety car had been the day before. Spoke with friend of the show, Martin Villari, about this, and he accurately points out that this looks like Antonelli over-demanded on the gearbox for downshifts and essentially stepped it down one too many ratios, causing the rear axle to essentially over-engine brake a little too hard, and that sent him round. So for your first time actually hammering round in this year's Mercedes, one that isn't perfect with its gearbox at a newly resurfaced Monza, I think it's a little more understanding to simply go, okay, there was reasons for this, as opposed to youthful exuberance and the fact that maybe you were absolutely hammering it out of Ascari faster than anyone else had done that entire session, or would do, rather. So, yeah, it's a multifaceted thing. And it's not like he was the only person to suffer incidents through FP1 either, with Sainz and Colapinto also having moments there.
To be fair, he followed the safety car line.
Yeah, a little too closely. But yeah, we saw Sainz catching a slide early on through Parabolica, and then Colapinto as well, was carried through the stones but made it to the recovery road around the edge. Ocon also looped it, but over the curbs at Ascari, the sort of penultimate or the final chicane. And it's worth noting that the curbs there had actually been reduced, which is great because the massive sausage curbs there were prone to spearing drivers into massive shunts, and especially the ones earlier chicanes as well were known for launching cars. We'd seen a horrendous crash in GT racing a few years back that pretty much obliterated an Aston Martin when it collected its side on. Equally, new surface proved to be an interesting one to get to grips with, relatively high deg, as I've already mentioned, but it rubbered in fairly quickly, though it remained quite dusty, so it's still...
When you think work, you think boots. You think boots, you think Ariat. You think grit, concrete, rain, and heat, and boots that never back down from any of it. You think comfort and durability that hold up on the job, off the clock, and every step in between. Because the day doesn't end when the job does. And from overtime to off-duty, you're thinking Ariat boots. Boots that show up, stand out, and always back you up. Now, it's time to stop thinking and start shopping. Find yours at Ariat.com or a retailer near you.
One that had a bit of a slick edge to it. The one thing that really threw a lot of the teams was the fact that it was actually a relatively closed face and compacted surface. So it didn't really rip into tyres anywhere near as much as they really were gambling on it doing so, which is why a lot of teams were surprised they could make a one-stop work. It also dispersed heat a lot better than teams were thinking it might do. And it still meant that it was a race that was going to be who could hold on to their tyres the best. And ultimately, when we get to the end of things, we know that it was Ferrari that they were able to do it. But we'll start with just championship leaders, Red Bull for the moment. And obviously, Verstappen P6, Perez P8. Timo, I'll let you lead in with your thoughts.
Well, just before I get to Red Bull, I just want to build off a point Catherine made earlier, because I've just remembered the fact that Mercedes, with their driver history and now signing Antonelli, he's going to be the first rookie at Mercedes since Carl Kling in 1954. And is going to be the third youngest driver in F1 history after Verstappen and weirdly Stroll. Which just records this year that are getting broken, as we said, I think, last week, that we weren't quite expecting.
It'll also be the first time in the modern Mercedes era that they won't have a world champion in their seat, won't it?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Which, very interesting. Red Bull, however, yeah, they just still don't understand what is wrong with that car, do they? Even having a different strategy from most others didn't really do them any favours. Verstappen hasn't won a Grand Prix since Spain, and before Zandvoort, the last time he was on the podium was Silverstone, which is kind of mad. But even madder is the fact that Perez hasn't finished inside the top five since Miami, and hasn't been on the podium since China. I mean, he's doing slightly better by his own standards, but it's a tough time for them, and it's going to be really interesting to see if they're able to do the bare minimum and be consistent in collecting points, especially for Verstappen, to seal that driver's title. But if they are hoping to get the constructors, they're going to have to change something real soon, because it's slipping and it might not just be McLaren coming for them at this rate.
It's got to hurt, hasn't it? I mean, you look back at their season and I think they've perhaps been struggling for a while with the car, but we didn't quite see those struggles because they were so dominant. You saw they weren't ever quite sure about sort of setups, and they also Max would also go on the radio and sort of complain about the car's performance. I just don't think we obviously saw it because they were so dominant, and now teams have caught up. You can see obviously those struggles are a lot more prominent. I think if you couple that with the fact that their upgrades have kind of been downgrades and they don't particularly know where to go with this car, it's probably not going to be a quick turnaround for the team to get this fixed. It reminds me a little bit of sort of Mercedes at the sort of start of, what was it, last year?
Ooh, that's a harsh but probably fair comparison. But it's just weirdly nice to hear.
Catherine, your thoughts on Red Bull's performance over the weekend?
I think it's a horrible sign when you ask Max Verstappen what he thinks the issue is, and his answer is everything. Everything's wrong, the car, the strategy. Like, he's just, I mean, he's not the happiest customer at the best of times. He's very critical, but the fact that he's not finding any positives at the moment isn't really a good sign. And there's a lot of obviously like focus on the fact that McLaren are probably definitely about to overtake them in the constructors. Like, there's no coming back from that. But I think people are negating the fact that Ferrari are definitely going to get them as well, which is very interesting. And obviously, the change in how much money they'll get, and the wind tunnel testing time will feed into next season, and hopefully we'll get closer racing again. But I'm just feeling that Red Bull are going to keep going on a downward trajectory, and I don't know what's going to bring them out of it.
It's going to be an interesting one to fix. And I think, yeah, like we said, leads in both their standings cut into again. I think the downfall of Red Bull is best exemplified at the moment by the Frankenflaut they're running this weekend and last. Elements of early flaws mixed with more recent concepts, just trying to find something that gives them balance. They've lost the sort of stability the car had. They've been trying to counteract that by adding or taking away more and less front wing and rear wing, but it's all centering around the floor at the moment. They aren't able to find one that really works and is able to work with the rest of the package. Their development and coordination have been dire since Miami, and it's not looking to get much better. The RB20 is sort of suffering from its own success. It's at the peak of its development and now on a razor's edge, teetering on sort of going a step beyond stable in a search for speed. And it's not a style of car that demands best of speed. It demands stability to keep the airflow lamina around it. And that's where its pace comes from. It's not a car that works best on outright speed. It's a car that works best when it's being clever about it. And maybe the ropier car is what Perez likes, having to fight and make it dance more than Max's style of a glued down car. Just sort of means that he's able to get that little bit closer performance-wise in comparison, or get to you, Timo. But either way, as the rest of the field hones their chassis through the year and into next, it's a question of where do Red Bull go next? They go back to the RB19? Do we get an RB19B? Or do they try and hone what they've got and make the RB20B and hope for the best? Timo?
Just going to say, if Perez likes a car that needs a bit of work to get it to perform, then what perfect time to swap him with Ricardo, you know? That RB's definitely not up to par. So maybe he can get something out of that car that Ricardo and Yuki can't, and Ricardo can get out of the Red Bull what he clearly can't. There we go. Problem solved. I'm a genius.
I thought you were going to offer him a seat at stake.
Oh, don't be silly. I'm not that cruel.
There's a car that needs developing. Speaking of a car that does seem to have gotten used to its developments, though, we'll move to this weekend's race winner and teammate, Charles Leclerc P1, Sainz P4. It's Ferrari, and Timo, you've put here an inspired gamble from Ferrari that paid off. Truly a rare occurrence.
Yeah, it just demonstrates perfectly that Ferrari are moving in the right direction and that you don't necessarily need the best car to win, despite what Norris claims after the race when he's trying to figure out how he lost and is looking everywhere except at himself. I think they said before the summer break that they were taking longer to understand the car with the upgrades that they'd put on it. But it looks like that in Zandvoort and Monza, they've kind of learned to understand them a bit more and get what they needed out of it. And they're now well and truly in this to spoil the party, because neither driver realistically is going to be fighting for the title. Leclerc could, I think, mathematically, but it would take a lot of stuff to happen to Norris and Stab for him to do that. And Ferrari can get the constructors, which is now going to be my kind of cheeky prediction for the rest of the season, because wouldn't that just be fun out of nowhere? But they've got nothing to lose by doing this. Ultimately, they were able to take this gamble yesterday because they were going to finish 3 and 4 anyway. So why not try and get at least one of your cars on the podium? And if you're going to get one of them on the podium, why not go for that win? And that's exactly what they did. It just shows that contrast of what a nice strategy that they can do, what they're capable of. You think back to Spa in 2022 and they're pitting Leclerc to go on the fastest lap and he loses the podium as a result, and you're going, what on earth was that about? And then you look at this and go, oh, thank God, they're learning finally. This is really moving in a positive direction, and some brilliant driving by both Leclerc and Sainz. As I say, with nothing to lose, everything to gain. And they pretty much did that.
I mean, looking at the predictions we made at the start of the year, both you and I do have Ferrari as champions. Ellie May has McLaren. Yeah,
really?
And we've all got Red Bull in second place, which is interesting to sort of look at and sort of to think, ooh.
I may be smarter than I think.
Yeah, I don't want to agree with you too much on that, but there is a chance. Ellie May, your
I'm
thoughts
I'm going
to
have to wear this to Abu Dhabi.
They pretty much ran the perfect race, didn't they? Especially in Leclerc's case. I mean, he split the McLarens early on, meaning they couldn't control the race like they would have wanted to. McLaren obviously pushed harder, which caused more tyre degradation and had to do what they thought should be a two-stop, whilst I think Ferrari pretty much planned to do the one-stop with Sainz beforehand and, you know, stuck with it. And Leclerc, they realised with the tyres would go through sort of that really bad grading phase and then come out of it fine if you stuck with it long enough. So it meant that whilst Piastri then was on quicker tyres after the second pit stop, that extra stop just meant he could not catch Leclerc out ahead, and all Leclerc really had to do was manage his tyres.
Catherine?
Yeah, seeing Ferrari make a different strategy call always strikes fear through my heart. But they knew that they were going to be in the points regardless, so it was worth it, and it did, you know, work out for them, which I'm very glad. Also, like, Singapore's the next race. It's a really good chance for a big points haul again. They seem to be, like, the start of the season, they were on an upward trajectory, and then it sort of fell apart kind of post-Monaco. That was, like, where it peaked. And then now they're building that momentum again, like, going from Zandvoort, where they really weren't expecting anything, and Charles saying, you know, it'd be a miracle to get on the podium and then doing it, to then having a win in Monza and in Singapore. Like, we just know that that is a strong track for them. I think hopefully they can keep going with this till the end of the season. They finally seem to have their team working together as a cohesive unit, making good decisions. The car's got a good setup. The drivers are happy. Like, it's all actually coming together finally for once.
Ferrari ever gone well in Baku as well? That's my real question, because I don't think they ever really have done.
Not recently.
No, I can't remember. The only one I can remember is when Seb went into the side of Hamilton. That was Baku, wasn't it?
Yeah. They clashed.
I was thinking
wheels
of when Charles and Carlos DNF'd a couple of years ago as well, which obviously is not what we want.
They haven't won when it's been called the Azerbaijan Grand Prix. And prior to that, it was sort of the European Grand Prix 2016.
So it's bad if you're having to go back that far already.
2016? No, they were fourth and fifth, which was Vettel, Raikkonen. No, that's qualifying there. Results, Vettel second, Raikkonen fourth. So they found some pace there, but once and nearly a decade ago. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see what Ferrari able to produce when we get to Baku. But, yeah, I think...
Leclerc got it on pole though, didn't he?
Yes, because that was one of the races where we started the sort of Verstappen wins from Leclerc pole. It was one of the
famous instances of pole means nothing when it comes to Leclerc. So
yes, yeah, but I think Ferrari winning a race that relied on them nailing a strategy entire day, I don't know what timeline we're operating on, but clearly it's a great one for F1, and perhaps it was all a show to embarrass Binotto, who was with stake this weekend as well. Regardless, it was a brilliant drive, and Charles nailed the start and was immediately pressuring the front row into Rettifilio, which paid off at the next chicane. Once in free air, he was able to manage his tyres and keep on top of the degradation to the stop. After that, he worked nicely to get a gap to pit into. Ferrari pulled off the stop and he was onto a home run, really. At that point, it was monitoring the pace, it was finding the gap, it was getting the stop done, and then afterwards just running it to home. Sainz is also worth remembering here for putting pressure on the McLarens from behind too. It's not just because he wasn't on the podium, it's easy to sort of write off his weekend, but the teamwork and the sort of the teammate pressure that he was able to put in was a lot better of a teammate job than we saw from McLarens, which I know we'll get to. So it sort of forced their hand, and a class act in the second car, and just a reminder of what he can do. Then we get to Mercedes. P5 for Hamilton, P7 for Russell.
A weird one again, wasn't it?
Yeah, I kind of wanted more, but at the same time, I don't quite know what more they could have done, because sort of on evaluation, they were kind of probably where they could have been, maybe Russell a little bit higher up. I think for me, it wasn't nice to see Hamilton beat himself up the way he did after qualifying and saying that perhaps Antonelli will bring that kind of performance on a Saturday that he can't at the moment. It's never really a nice thing to hear. And it kind of, we sort of saw it in when did he win in Silverstone?
Hamilton won in Silverstone,
yes. I remember he won, but I just couldn't remember which race it was. How he didn't really think he doubted that he still had it in him to win a race. It's, you know, you're a 7-time world champion, and it's not nice to hear you still having, you know, doubts about your own performance.
Yeah, it was an interesting one, especially, I mean, from that perspective with Hamilton, because it's weird to have that from him. As much as he is human, it's still unnerving to hear that. And Russell, he's just having a bit of a an odd season, been mired with woes recently, sadly. I mean, he does a brilliant race in Spa, then gets disqualified. Zandvoorty starts higher up and then finishes lower down than where he started. And you have the same here, and essentially because of first turn incidents. I mean, not even making it first turn, essentially. And you just think, oh, he can't catch a break at the moment. Go on, say what you want to say.
Do you know what it is?
Oh, what have you done? Did you buy merch?
No, after Austria, I put him in my fantasy league team.
Oh, that's what it is. No, take him out immediately. Put Norris in there. Let's have some fun with it.
Hang on, no, because he won Spa, despite being in your fantasy league.
Oh, yeah.
No, but then he
won it and then got disqualified. Oh,
Russell
that's
did.
Good
yeah.
luck, is it?
Oh, I thought it was sort of.
No, no. But yeah, either way, not a good Grand Prix for Mercedes, but not a bad one either. They're still understanding the car in some way. So while we have seen that improvement on summer break, it's still obviously not all told. And yeah, kind of Russell just under them at the start, and not much to say on Hamilton, really. It was just a little bit. It was a shame. There could have been more there. I feel like this is one of those Grand Prix where there was opportunity to make hay while the sun shines, and they didn't.
Catherine?
Mercedes just having a very odd season. I mean, a lot of the teams are, but even in the constructors, they're in no man's land. Like, they're so far back from Ferrari, but so far ahead of Aston Martin. And like, Lewis is putting in some really consistent drives and tends to go unnoticed. Like, last season, didn't win, but he still made it into third. George has done some really good recovery drives, and he did put in a fair recovery on Sunday, but he's often the position, like, puts himself in that position to do it. Like, the first turn was a shame, but I feel like I don't know if they could have done particularly more this weekend than what they did.
We just never got to see them try anything in the way that Ferrari got to try it. If he'd been up there, I'm not saying he would have got on the podium or would have won even, but it would have been just an extra element for McLaren and Ferrari to deal with. And by kind of taking himself out in that first turn incident, he prevented all that from happening. So it was a case of what if, I feel.
And they clearly have one of the faster cars now, but they're not making an impact with that, which is really weird.
It's the second year as well, isn't it, that Russell has gone off the track at Monza at first turn.
Can't remember if he did it last year, but wouldn't surprise me.
Take your word for it.
I mean, Monza is a circuit that rewards being in clear air, and unfortunately for the Mercedes, he
avoided all of the traffic in front of him.
Yeah, through turns one and two, and did clip one of the boulards as well. But yeah, I mean, it's a circuit that rewards a clean air, and if you find yourself back in the fighting pack, it's a lot trickier to get through. So it becomes one of those circuits that's a little more annoying to deal with. But both drivers were absolutely on it. But I think the problem we're seeing is a bit like the Red Bull, is that we're getting to a ceiling of what's achievable with that chassis. And it's sort of approaching peak development. And it's going to make 2025 a hell of a lot more interesting if we've got cars that already sort of maxed out on stats builds and you don't know what they're able to produce afterwards. But McLaren are ones that have still got something to offer. P2 and P3 for Piastri and Norris. And I think there's a lot to unpack with them.
Starting with Piastri, though, because his lap one overtake on Norris was absolutely fantastic. I don't care about the rest of it too much in terms of right or wrong. It was just sublime. I mean, it showed what Norris needs to do if he wants to win, and here's a driver with nothing to lose going, oh, papaya rules, yeah, couldn't give a shit, mate. I'm going to do whatever I want to do, and that's be a racing driver. And you can kind of really tell that Mark Webber is his manager and going, there are times where you will do the team thing and you will listen to your team and you will do as they ask. Other times, you do what you want to do because you need to make sure that you are not lost in the haze of everything and get sidelined unnecessarily. And this is just kind of one of those times where maybe from now on he'll play the team game because he'll be asked to and he'll just say, yep, no problem, because mathematically he's not in for contention, Norris is. But he's just going, I can do this though. And if you decide to mess me about in whatever way, two can play at that game. And this is a perfect example of that. And also, just the place on the track where he did it is not a place where we see a lot of successful overtakes. We see a lot of attempts, especially in feeder series, not all of them go that well. And it clearly caught Norris off guard. And then it looked like it was kind of Piastri's Grand Prix. And I love the fact that it was Ferrari that beat him. It wasn't Norris. Norris couldn't do anything about it. And by contrast, even though Norris finished ahead of Verstappen and ate into his championship lead, if Ferrari, Mercedes and Piastri keep doing what they're doing, and Norris doesn't change, then Verstappen wins the title as much through his own efforts as through Ferrari, Mercedes and Piastri helping him get there, which is just weirdly quite satisfying from a drama and fan perspective. Interesting that they couldn't do a one-stop either. I guess they just didn't anticipate Ferrari being able to successfully gamble for a change, which is understandable to an extent because we're not used to that. But Piastri just... You could see how much Norris was annoyed come the end of that Grand Prix. And I don't know, that was quite enjoyable.
We'll jump in quickly on the McLaren strategy thing, because obviously once they had neither driver in the clear air, they were suffering trying to keep sort of the front end of the car pinned down. And we saw that it was scrubbing through front tyres a hell of a lot quicker than they anticipated, which caused them to pull the trigger on the undercut. They had no other way of even keeping a competitive race if it wasn't for sort of actually just making that early stop and hoping they'd be able to squeeze out a second stop at some point. Monza's famous for having a late safety car. It was a gamble worth taking, but at the end of the day, it didn't pay off for them. And it's a circuit they just found was chewing through tyres, and without that clean air balance, going through things like Curva Grande and Parabolica, it's just going to start obliterating tyres as the front end pushes wide. You're fighting understeer the entire time. And it's not like it's through slow speed corners. Curva Grande, you're going through there flat at sort of 160, 170 mile an hour. That's going to really start to take chunks out of even a medium or hard Pirelli at that point. So it's an interesting one. I'll get back to my other thoughts on their strategy, their sort of rest of their driver strategy in a second, but Ellie May.
Sorry, I'm just having a giggle about the way you said Boulard.
Yeah, it's a long-running joke I've got with a couple of other people. It's, yeah. I think it stems back from when Sebastian Vettel had brake failure and just clattered through the lot of them. And I don't know why it stemmed from there. But
yeah, I mean, they're coming out of another race with missed opportunities and a lot of questions. It's kind of like they forgot how to be a championship winning team where it's been so long. You know, they've got two quick drivers and at the moment kind of the quickest car on the grid, and they're not maximizing on it. You know, they potentially had an opportunity to come out this weekend level on points with Red Bull for the constructors, but are instead 8 points behind them. Equally, the gap between Norris and Verstappen is 62, but that gap could have been 52. I completely understand that they don't want to be seen as having a favorite driver that gets preferential treatment, but I don't actually think we, and I kind of mean we as in the F1 community, would see it as a bad thing if Norris was to get preferential treatment in this instance, because he's realistically the only driver who's in a chance at beating Verstappen in the drivers' championship. And I mean, we're pretty used to seeing teams giving one driver preferential treatment if they have more of a likelihood in succeeding. If it was at the start of the season, when we haven't seen how good both drivers are and how they're doing, or, you know, it would be a bit weird that one of them was getting preferential treatment. But I think with less than 10 races to go, I think if McLaren want a chance at winning both championships, they need to give Norris preferential treatment, because the inter-team battle this race is really what allowed Leclerc to win it, and it cost them ultimately as a team.
Catherine?
Yeah. It's definitely getting to the stage where if they don't make a choice about whether Lando is their first driver or their drivers are equal, they're going to lose that opportunity. I think maybe they were a bit worried that they weren't, like, the constructors was more possible than the drivers, but actually both are possible, so they need to make the choice about it. And they should prioritize Lando. I'm like, Piastri is my favorite driver, so it's, you know, hard for me to say it, but they need to think about making this happen for Lando. But also,
so from a logical point of view, it just makes sense, doesn't it? You'd kind of take that if you're the team, you're just going, this is the best option for us to get both of them. And also, if we've got Piastri as a rear gunner, he's probably going to be in a good position to help on the constructors' front. So, yeah.
Yeah, they've got, like, what is possibly the strongest driver pairing, or one of the stronger ones, and they're not really making the use of that to aid them at the moment. which is a shame. And then their kind of excuse for things this season has been like, oh, well, we're underdogs, so like we're just trying our best here. But that doesn't work when they have what is the fastest car. Like, the underdog excuse isn't a thing. They need to get it together and make decisions. Otherwise, they're just not going to win. And who knows when they'll have such a close, like, opportunity to do this again. There's no guarantee that they'll have this shot again next season at doing that.
It's like they don't realise that they can win both championships here. It's really weird.
It's a little bit lost on them. I think their focus is definitely on constructors, because for them, that's where the money is. The glory is with drivers, but the money, which is what ultimately they need to go into next year, is with the constructors. And maybe they're just sort of blindly plowing on with one over the other. But I think what they need to do is redefine what they mean by papaya rules, because clearly that seems to mean a million different things to a million different people. And as much as I love Piastri's move through the Della Roggia chicane, it opened the door for Charles to slip through too, and that's what caused the problem. Was it's not necessarily the fact that Piastri fought Norris. They were for that. They said, you can fight your teammate, do it. But I think the thing they should have specified was, just don't do it in a way that allows someone else to come through too. It was a fantastic move, and I'm impressed at what Piastri did and was able to make it work cleanly as well, without contact. But then Charles coming through forces them off strategy. Pitting Norris for the undercut was a bold one, as I've already said. So, yeah, it's an interesting one. It's a lot for Woking to unpack and reassess. Baku and Singapore are going to be tricky to predict. Monza would have been their last good chance until COTA to take a big chunk out of Red Bull's lead in both constructors' and drivers' titles. If they came home 1-2, but with their start order inverted, fine. But they didn't. And in a season that's running out of time, it's likely going to be a close thing, and maximising these final opportunities is vital. By COTA, if they keep this progress up, they still might not have overhauled Red Bull in the constructors. Worse still, they might have been overhauled themselves by Ferrari. And that would be a crying shame if you're McLaren to have thrown that away.
That's the thing, right?
Lando's also given his career to this team. So for them, when he has the best chance he could ever have at winning the Drivers' Championship, for them to not fully back that is such a shame. Because then it starts to put questions in his mind of, okay, well, I've given everything to this team. They're now not giving everything to me. Is this where I want to stay and keep dedicating my time to if they're not giving that back to me?
I kind of have two more things to say, in that I think it was, I like that it was ballsy from Piastri. I kind of like the move, but at the same time, it's a risky move to what then caused him to then get second place again, basically. He's starting where he finished. And the other thing is, they're no longer racing for the win. At some point, they know they're not going to catch Leclerc. Why not swap Lando and Piastri? What's the difference between second and third at this point?
I think the problem was the gap between. If they had to start sort of floating around trying to get that gap sorted, Sainz would have easily raced up to the back of them, and then they would have been at risk of losing not just one but two places if Sainz had gotten through while they're trying to manufacture a swap. They got away with it in Hungary because of the distance the two drivers had over the field behind them. But if they'd tried that here with the pace Ferrari were showing, it took them both a fair while after their second stop to get back past Sainz. This would have been a huge fumble had they tried to then invert at a later point in time and Sainz came back through. That would have been an even bigger dropped ball. And I think to a certain extent, it was wise that they didn't. But we'll move on.
I think as well, like you were saying about McLaren having to maximise as much as they can and do so before COTA, even if that's probably their next best chance, because Baku and Singapore can be quite unpredictable. Like with Monza, they've got to realise that it's not enough to just beat Red Bull, which seems to be straightforward at the moment. It's to keep an eye on Ferrari and Mercedes, and particularly at these next two Grand Prix, maybe a few of the other teams as well, because craziness can happen at these venues. We've seen a lot of wild Grand Prix in the past, and you don't want to finish 3-4 when you could be finishing 1-2, and then somehow you've got Aston Martin and Williams in 1-2 or something. You know, that's the kind of stuff we could get, which is the least crazy time of year to say it. And if they it's bad enough fumbling this with Ferrari and with Mercedes potentially, but if you fumble it there with that kind of a situation, that's going to be the point where we look back at the end of the season and go, that is actually maybe where it was. I mean, it's kind of one of those things where we can always say, what if, what if, what if, but that would seem like a very easy slam dunk word, or that where it's a bit more plausible to make that case.
I mean, you've only got to look at the pace that Magnussen actually had in the Haas, irregardless of his penalties and things. He was way up in the points over the weekend. If you have, I don't know, a circuit that relies on huge straight line speed, like, I don't know, Baku coming up, that could be a real threat if you're a team that's unprepared to have to deal with that. Meanwhile, if you're Aston Martin, just sort of cross your fingers and pray. They're next on our list, Alonso P11, Stroll P19. Timo, go on then.
Got to bring it back to Piastri with a quote of the day by saying Stroll was driving like it was his first go-kart race, which I just thought, yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah. Stroll also weirdly pitted on the penultimate lap, which was odd, and naturally he just fell down the order as a result. I wasn't sure if he was trying to go fastest lap or what he was trying to do there. I mean, he can't have been going fastest lap because he must realise he's Lance Stroll and he's not going to get that, especially in that Aston Martin this year. So I'm really kind of confused as to that. Alonso, meanwhile, yeah, it was just a bit of a frustrating Grand Prix, but again, I think more or less where we expected them to be. I mean, we were saying in Zandvoort that they positioned themselves rather nicely. So it was a shame that they couldn't kind of stay there a bit more, whereas this felt more kind of business as usual, as bad as that is.
Yeah. Piastri, I think I really love that line from Piastri. It was like Stroll was driving in his first karting race. But I think the interesting one was actually Alonso's reaction to it, realizing that his car just didn't have the pace. Knowing where he sits points wise, he can just sort of muck around when he's outside of the points. Because he said that if he knew Colapinto was behind him to the line, he would have backed off to swap positions and let Colapinto finish his debut race P11, which is a big change.
He loves that character. From Alonso.
The Alonso who had sit in a pit box to deny Hamilton a quali shot. This is a huge change in his character, but it's also the sign of a guy that's possibly not necessarily checked out, but just viewing the championship a little bit differently and maybe not quite as competitively. He's not got the car under him that he did last season or sort of before that point. He's just dossing around at this point, waiting for maybe Adrian Newey to turn up and actually start building a proper chassis. It's a very weird spot to see Aston Martin in. They just seem to be resting on their laurels, waiting, because they know that Minardi aren't coming to catch them from behind on points. They know that their two drivers are sitting pretty in P9 and P10 overall in the standings. And there's another points gap to the guys behind that they're untouchable. So they just...
It's like Catherine was saying earlier, constructors-wise, they're in their own kind of no man's land. No one's kind of close enough behind them to do anything, and they're too far back themselves from Mercedes to go after that. So they're just kind of sitting there going, what are we... do for the rest of the season then? Do we try anything, or do we just kind of we go driving, I suppose?
Turn up, do the best you can, but don't risk anything, because we don't have to start spaffing money onto replacement parts if you bend it. That's basically where they are, is just sort of turn up and do the bare minimum, which is, to be fair, been Lance Stroll's sort of modus operandi since he joined the sport, it seems. Anyone else, thoughts on Aston Martin?
It's just been a forgettable season for them. Like, they're going to finish fifth in the constructors, same as last season, but last season they were much closer to making progress from that. This is much more underwhelming, and it is like they are just trying to kind of get to the end of it now and hoping that Newey goes there and that they have some massive turnaround. Like, they're kind of not really making any impact on the season, and I haven't paid much attention to them because of that.
You haven't missed much if you weren't paying attention to them.
Yeah, there's not really much to say about them, which is the sad part about this how the season's going for Aston Martin. You know, last year, at the start of last year, they were on it, and it's just increasingly declined with no real answers. What I would have liked to have seen, if Alonso was going to let Colapinto pass, with Magnussen's 10-second penalty, Alonso was only a fraction out of getting Magnussen's point. So if Colapinto had put his foot down and been sort of within those 10 seconds of Magnussen, he would have been quite nice to see him get a first point on debut.
Would have done Nick de Vries.
Would have ticked off my prediction as well.
Well, that's why we couldn't let it happen. That's right.
Because I predicted it, it couldn't happen at all. Meanwhile, from one performance to yet another relatively one, it's Minardi, it's RB, it's Toro Rosso. P13 for Ricciardo, Tsunoda DNF. Tsunoda does not like Monza, clearly. I think he has
no, that was quite an interesting rap sheet that they were listing off for him during the Grand Prix, and you kind of go, oh yeah, that is right, actually, now that you mention it. And you go, oh yeah, he's not going to be looking too fondly at this rate back at Monza when it comes to the end of his career. An unfortunate DNF. It's not really much he could do about it, just sustained a lot more damage than I thought he did. It looked like an all right hit, but it didn't look like that bad a hit either. So that was interesting. And Ricciardo, it was interesting because I think with how F1 is policed these days, that first penalty he received was kind of fair enough. I mean, it's a shame we can't have a bit more rough and tumble racing, but I get why he got that. The second one was unfortunate because of the pit crew touching his car, so that was frustrating and kind of out of his control. So P13 is not as representative as I want it to be, a bit like Magnussen with his penalty. And for me, during the Grand Prix at least, Ricciardo did show some decent pace at times. It was just all for everything else happening around him that dampened it and made it a bit of that meh race, like you say. And it seemed like he had some old flair back at times, which was nice to see. It's just a shame that ultimately didn't translate to a result on track. And it's just unfortunate because it's one of those human error things with the pit crew. It was just, he knew as soon as he touched it, oh, bollocks, I shouldn't be doing that. And at that point, it's already too late, and you go, it's one of those we win and we lose as a team situations. And it frustrates me again because I'm like, Ricciardo can't do anything about it at that point. He's not told him to touch the car, really. He doesn't want a 10-second penalty. He's just trying to drive, but that's just the way it is, unfortunately.
There's a great top-down shot as Ricciardo's car comes in, and you can see everyone waiting, but obviously it's just the muscle memory to go, my job is stabilize front wing. And it just happens before he's even had a chance to process what's happening. And then you sort of blink and you go, oh, bugger, I've done that. So, yeah, a bit of an interesting one. But the Tsunoda DNF, obviously, I think it must have been cooling or oil lines that were damaged in the Hülkenberg collision. I just think the RB could have been speedier this weekend. It just seems to be lacking all round. It didn't have the stability. It didn't have the grip. It didn't have the speed. It had nothing. It was like a Red Bull, an F1 car reset to its most basic statistics. And against the rest of the field, that just wasn't going to cut anything.
I don't know. I think there was more on the table for them this weekend. It just didn't work out for them. I think they could have got a point or two, but obviously things didn't work out with Yuki retiring after a few laps with, you know, side pod and whatever underneath it, radiators or whatnot, damaged. I think the 5-second penalty wasn't the end of Ricciardo's race. It was the 10-second penalty, not serving the first penalty, that hurt him. I think he probably might have been teetering on the edge of points or in.
So many drivers nearly getting that P10 at the end. It's frustrating when you look at it and think if everything had just gone properly, there's at least six drivers probably that could have been in with getting that.
Catherine, have you got anything to say on RB, or are you happy to move on to Williams?
RB, it's really just they need every point they can get because they're in such a tight battle with Haas at the moment. And having things like, obviously, you know, human error happens, but that in a combination with a season that's had slow car and questionable strategy at times, they're just, not getting it all together. And I kind of, in a way, hope that they lose out to Haas because it would also be very good for Haas to have made so much progress too. But yeah, not really much more to say than that.
Very thin on the ground, unlike, in a sort of sense, Williams. Albon P9, Colapinto P12. Timo.
Yeah, Albon P9 securing points for the team in Williams that always does decent at Monza. It was nice to see Colapinto with a very decent debut as well. Bit of a what-if case as well for me, though, because of his compromised qualifying after going off a little bit at Lesmo 2. It was a shame because it would have been interesting to see what he would have been capable of. We're saying just now anyway, but six drivers could have been up for that final spot, and this is a second way he could have been one of those drivers, but not too shabby. And strong to see, and it's going to be interesting to figure out how they do in the next two, and particularly next four, really, because especially with Colapinto, because you've got two crazy races potentially coming up, two Grand Prix where Considering history, you've got to be very quick on your reactions to stay out of trouble, and just surviving can often bring home a lot of points for you. So whilst Monza was a good place for Colapinto to start, we should probably take his debut with a pinch of salt, because they've always been strong there. And I don't want to take anything away from him, because he still had to do the job, and he still did a very decent job, especially in the Williams that is nowhere near the par yet. But the test is now actually going to start.
I think it was a good race for them, you know, obviously Albon in the points, but Albon did say on the radio how he hates how indecisive the team is in strategy calls, which he has also said in previous races. So I think that definitely needs to be addressed a lot better. For Colapinto, I think it was a good first solid race, but what is more amusing for me is that he's done one race and he is not last in the driver's standing. Bottas
Damn
is
you.
Last.
This was my fun fact.
Sorry. I looked
at it. I was going to say that his P12 in one race already means he's ahead of Bottas in the Drivers' Championship, because Bottas hasn't been able to finish higher than P13 all year. So he's already better than a Grand Prix winner. That was going to be my whole point for state, because normally there's nothing to say about them. But we'll just talk about them now and I won't have to bother. Because, yeah, I was going to say nil point again, but then this is just hammering it home even more that this is how bad you are as a unit stake. New guy at Williams, who've been racing in Formula 2 all season, beats your F2 graduate with multiple seasons under his belt and your Grand Prix winner and constructors champion, essentially driver that helped Mercedes, and Franco Colapinto go, yeah, I can do better than that. And this was a weekend where, like we just said, he could have done better. This was him at potentially his worst for this weekend. Great for Williams, terrible for Stake. I say no more.
The only thing I have to say on Stake is that at one point Bottas was in P10, and I think that's a real achievement for the team.
Yeah, for a brief moment. Unfortunately, didn't make any points. But yeah, I think for me on Williams, it's progress and it's what we want to see. Clean weekend from Franco on his debut, despite not scoring. And like I've already mentioned, ahead of Bottas. Monza, as again, as we already said, it's a good circuit for Williams. And Franco has a great history here as well. He knows the circuit and really understands its sort of quirks and foibles. So a small pinch of salt is worth taking here, but that's not to sort of diminish it. And equally, I think, if now Williams are looking at the other aspects of their race weekend, if they're looking at the strategy, the decisions they're making, how confident they are in making the speed at which they're making them, that suggests they've got a lot more faith in the car. They're able to move their sort of weekend progress away from simply going make car quick to make race better. And I think that is a key shift that we want to start seeing. Previously, when we see teams that are struggling, it's always a case of need to make a car quicker. Everything else will fall into place. Williams are now getting to the point where it's now getting everything else to fall into place. And that's, for me, a really big step when it comes to their development. And it's what we want to see as they move on. We're already blending into stake. We might as well jump into it. Bottas P16, Joe P18, pretty terrible race from them, but equally the same as usual. Was nice to see, though, the Bottas lookalike fella being given paddock passes so he can enjoy stake's lack of form from the comfort of their hospitality suite. I don't know if anyone else saw that across the weekend, but pretty much like an absolute sort of genetic clone of Bottas rocked up and they went, oh my God, give that man a paddock pass.
I feel like, though, if I changed my hair into a mug and put a moustache on, I could...
We'd have bigger questions about you. Like, are you okay?
I just think it's easy to be a Bottas lookalike.
He has a very distinct appearance these days. Yeah, weird Finnish Australian hybrid. But anyway, yeah, regardless, stake uninspired weekend. Again, what more interested in what they're getting up to off track than actually what they're able to do on track. And interesting. However, Bottas is likely going to be staying on at the team with Hülkenberg next to him when it becomes Audi, which suggests that Joe is possibly looking for something else to do. The long-running joke has always been if you get booted from F1, you simply end up back in Chinese F4, but I think Joe's probably already ticked that one off the box, so maybe whack, I suppose. Haas, next on our list. Magnussen P10, Hülkenberg P17. I don't know if anyone's seen Magnussen's sort of summation of the weekend on his Instagram post, but he's got a little extra bit of a holiday until Singapore, so he can kick back and relax.
Of an unfortunate race for them, wasn't it? Because especially with Hülkenberg, not much he could do after the car was damaged. But it was nice to see Magnussen kind of doing what he's supposed to do, I suppose, in that other Haas for a change, because normally if Hülkenberg doesn't perform, then neither one of them do. Whereas this time Magnussen took it a little personally and went, no, I'm going to go and I'm going to drive. I'm going to get that point. I don't care how many people I've got to drive into to get there. And that was a good strategy because it worked and got him at least that one championship point. Could have been a bit more. I think a little bit like what I was saying with Ricciardo, with the hard driving that got him his first penalty. I can understand why he got it, so I can understand why Magnussen has ended up in the position he's in, where he's going to have to miss Baku and Behrmann's probably going to step in for him. But for me, it's a bit of a shame because I do like this kind of rough and tumble sort of racing style. Maybe I'm watching too much IndyCar and NASCAR and I'm just wanting drivers to get away with a bit more. Which obviously you've got some instances like his attempted overtake of Sargeant back in Miami. That was great fun to watch, but absolutely appalling in terms of an attempt. But that's kind of the fun side of F1. I like that you've got to try these things. And I think if you penalize drivers too much for that, then you're not going to necessarily see an overtake like Piastri's on Norris. He's going to think, oh, if I have ever so slight contact with him, I'm going to get a 5-second penalty. It's not worth it. So in two minds about that one. But it was just nice to see Magnussen perform, even if it now has lost him.
I would like to know sort of the reasoning behind why Kevin was awarded a 10-second penalty over sort of Ricciardo and Hülkenberg's 5.
It was to do with control of the car. Hülkenberg and Danny Ric were deemed to sort of still be in control of the car. It was the fact that Magnussen's was deemed as more dangerous or more reckless because he wasn't fully in control of the car at the moment he made contact with Gasly. And you've got to look at it, and everyone goes, oh yeah, well, they just sort of were able to make for the gravel and get away with it. You've got to view it completely abstract of the circuit you do it on, because if it was the race weekend after and that had happened at Baku, into the wall, clatter, both of them out of the race, different result. You've got to view it abstract of the circuit, abstract of a possible outcome. You've just got to view
that's why they timed it for this, because they didn't want to risk Magnussen being let loose in Baku.
Maybe that's what it was, but ultimately it was a clumsy move on Gasly, and 10 seconds was a big penalty considering that Hülkenberg got 5 for his clash with Yuki, who was then forced out of the race. But they never do it based on consequence. It's always based on driver action. And the penalty points on top of that really sours things further. I think that was overstepping the mark, possibly. 10 seconds, yeah, you've sort of pretty much eliminated his race, but you don't have to eliminate him very much physically from the next one. Behrmann likely going to be subbing in for Baku. We haven't heard news of that yet. They've got a little time to announce it, but he's not really in the hunt for F2 titles, so it's not really going to ruin his year there. So it makes sense for him to move up, get a bit more seat time with his future team. It's not going to hurt things overall, but otherwise
they can stick Marta Garcia in that frame. There we go. Sorted.
No, you move
don't
up.
Don't disagree
Dorian.
With me. No,
move,
don't care.
Up Dorian
no,
Pound
because
she's
Marta's
the higher-ranking
Primer anyway.
Yeah, but
don't care.
Dorian
Marta, no, because Marta's won a championship. She's gone to Freca as a promotion. Dorian's to the F1 Academy, and she's about 2. So leave her there for a little bit and give Marta a chance.
Just because she's 2, that doesn't mean she can't move up. Mercedes moved up Kimi Antonelli, and he's like,
yeah,
a
look
fetus.
How well that's going to go.
Yeah, so, we'll wait and see.
Catherine, do you have anything to say on Haas before Jesse and I bicker some more?
It's mainly about Magnus. Nice. Like, I'm going to miss him from the sport. He's, you know, such a special driver. How many people can get points and a race ban in one day?
Did Grosjean ever achieve that?
Yeah, like that's probably peak form for his career, really. Sums it up. Like, he's made so many races more exciting than they could have been. Probably, you know, other drivers may not have the same love towards him, but from a fan perspective, it's been great.
Petition to keep at least one on-track terrorist for next season just to keep things spicy.
Yeah, I think we should just sort of rotate him in for races that tend to be a bit more boring. Like, maybe just sort of sub him in for, like, Monaco and send him around.
All the street circuits.
I had this theory last year that whenever a race was boring, Magnussen would look up at the screen and just press this detonate engine button and his engine would just go kaput, and suddenly we'd have a really exciting race because everyone's going into the pits during the safety car window, and we ended up sort of having a lot of exciting races because of Magnussen's misfortune, basically. But in terms of, I mean, we'll probably see Behrmann in the next race. I think it's kind of good for Haas maybe, because then he might be able to perhaps let Haas know how differently that Haas differs to the Ferrari during a race, because obviously he had to sub in earlier in the season. Yeah. And it could potentially be quite valuable, especially as he's now subbing in for two street tracks as well.
Hmm. It's a big ask. We'll wait and see how it pans out. I think at this point in time, we're actually...
Also, sorry, just worth noting, Behrmann in Baku in F2 last year, absolute fire. So maybe, imagine. I'll wait for predictions for Baku.
We'll wait and see how it goes. And he might do better than he did with the Ferrari in Saudi, on the grounds of he'll actually have more than 45 minutes to get used to the car before qualifying. So we could be on for interesting things here. At this point, we are also stalling, talking about Alpine, because Ocon P14, Gasly P15, can it still be called underwhelming at this point? It's just whelming.
They showed up. A standard race for them, really.
They showed up and had enough reliability to finish the race.
Oh, that's a hurdle for them to cross. I'll give them that. I mean, otherwise, pretty bland from them. So we might as well move straight from... This is going to be a very short chapter on the YouTube, but we'll move straight from them into our winners and spinners. And Timo, we'll start at the top of the list when it comes to winners. We'll go for yours, please, and thank you.
It's obvious to say Ferrari, so I say Williams. Just another weekend where it's been encouraging for them, as we've said. And I'm just going to say it quietly like that and not add too much onto it, so I don't want to tempt fate.
That's all right. I'll accept your thought process. Ellie May, your winner.
I've gone for us as fans, because at the end of the day, who doesn't love seeing a Ferrari win at Monza? And we're increasingly seeing more fans, we're seeing more races too, where you just don't know who is going to win until they cross the line. And the constructors' title is a lot closer than it has been in a couple of years. Plus, the Monegasque national anthem followed by the Italian national anthem is just top tier.
It's not quite German and Italian yet, but it could be something I could buy into.
I mean, we're going to get British and Italian next year, which is going to be really interesting.
It's not as, they're not as good as national anthems. The Monegasque national anthem and the Italian national anthem are two very happy, joyous national anthems.
But the other ones are just more ingrained in my memory, so I just like them more from that. I've heard the Monegasque national anthem about as many times as Leclerc had won, and as we can count all of those pretty easily, it's not, and it's
seven
the gap
times
between those.
Yeah,
well, yeah, it's.
He can start a new tradition.
I'm not against it. I'm just saying I'm going to need a bit more time to like it as much as you do.
I will say though that speaking of Leclerc winning, he didn't win from pole. Norris had pole. Norris obviously fumbled it from pole. Leclerc is also famous for never being able to win from pole. In fact, Verstappen has more Leclerc pole conversions to win. Leclerc and Norris now also share the same ratio for pole to win ratios. I think Leclerc's is essentially double, but they both 20% of the time will actually win if they're on pole, which is not a great percentage to have. Is if you're on pole, there is a 20% chance you're winning this race. You're like, oh, come on, Lando, you should be doing better than this. At least Charles with a Ferrari has long had the excuse of Ferrari incompetence to actually sort of fumble it. Norris has had none of those reasons. It's just him, which is interesting.
I'll have to go back and look at my predictions, but I'm pretty sure at one point I predicted a Leclerc win off a Norris pole.
What, in like the race-by-race predictions?
Yeah.
Verstappen.
Kind of like a you're me now kind of thing. I remember us having this kind of sort of conversation.
Monaco, you predicted a Leclerc pole and a Norris win.
Maybe it was that way around then.
Norris, Verstappen, Norris. No, you've never predicted a Norris pole Leclerc win, weirdly enough.
So it's the
you've got something to do for the rest of the season.
Yeah.
Catherine, your winner from the weekend.
I pick the boring answer and went like Ferrari. The fact that they pulled it all together, it worked out. And even if it didn't, they still would have had points. It just, yeah, it went perfectly. And it happened to be perfect at Monza, which makes it even better. And it's a great spectacle for everyone. I don't think there's anyone who would hate to see Ferrari and Charles win at Monza. Like, it's a good outcome for everyone, except maybe some salty or Red Bull fans and maybe some salty Lando fans.
Yeah, I side with you on that one. I think for my winner, I've picked Charles Leclerc, because you can't hate it. The selfie of him up on the podium with just the sea of Tifosi filling the start-finish line. You're looking at it going, Chef's kiss, I love it. Give me 14 more of them. You're like, oh, I just want it over and over because it's just again, so it's, good.
It's the fact that he's won Monaco and Monza in the same year. Like he said, like they just obviously want to win as many Grand Prix as you can, but those are, if you're Ferrari and if you're him, are the most important races you want to win each year. Kind of funny that he didn't mention Imola. But it just, it kind of ticks that box in terms of if he'd said to us at the start of the season that he's going to win Monaco, finally. He's going to win in Monza. And Lewis breaks the ducks back at Silverstone. You're going,
what sort of season are you predicting?
That's not going to bloody happen.
You can't have all of your cake.
We haven't even had all of the races yet, you know? This is just so far. So, yeah, I think, like you both say, no one can be unhappy with that.
Yeah. Interestingly, the only other drivers I can think of that have also won Monza and Monaco in the same season are, I think, Vettel, Verstappen, and Alonso. So he's up there with the world champions for banging out the Moz together, the Monzas and the Monaco. So that's impressive in the same season as well. We'll move then into the opposite side of this coin, our spinners. And team, I'm going to go to you, and that will give Ellie Mae a little bit more thinking time because she's simply written, I don't know, on the spreadsheet. Timo.
Yeah, I kind of felt similar to Ellie Mae because it feels pointless to just keep alternating between Alpine and Stake because we know why they don't win and why they indeed spin. So I went for Mercedes because it felt like there was more on the table for them to get their hands on this weekend, and it was a shame that they weren't able to capitalize on that, both through qualifying and then also qualifying weirdly because of Russell qualifying as high as he did and then just fumbling it through kind of just not kind of, obviously the alternative was driving to the back of Piastri, which you don't want to do, but then it compromised him. He had a great recovery, but just when you start that high and you could have been in the mix and you see that McLaren was beatable and Red Bull was nowhere, it's smart.
Yeah, it's sort of very much the Lando Norris what-if situation, but somehow applied to Mercedes this weekend. Ellie Mae, have you got us a spinner?
Just don't know. You know, you know in that episode of the Graham Norton show where he's interviewing Judy Walters and he goes to ask her a question and she's just like, leave me alone.
Oh yeah, that one. Yeah. Is this where we're at now?
Pretty much. Like I don't know. Maybe Red Bull. I mean, their lead is diminishing quite fast. They don't have a great race for them.
Catherine, I'll come to you then. Have you got a spinner from the weekend? Someone that really ought to have impressed you a bit more?
Mine is Lando Norris. He needs to stop going backwards at the start of races. Like, it's now, it's almost like the Charles pole to Max win conversion. Like, it's expected now that Lando's on pole, he's going to start going backwards. Like, he even did it in Zandvoort and then he recovered from it, which is great. But yeah, I don't know how his starts are just so, like, weak is maybe too strong a word, but just lacking. Like, to be world champion material, you need to have like basic things like that down. You can't keep making those mistakes. And the fact that he's not really learned from that at all this season, it's still happening. I don't know what he needs to do to fix this.
There's a strange refusal to learn.
I think
I was saying on another F1 podcast earlier that good news is he made it through turn one in the lead from pole. However, he still has not made it to the end of lap one in the lead from pole. So progress, but also really not good enough progress considering it's race 16.
Yeah, and there's a lot of conversation about how obviously Oscar is costing Lando crucial championship points, but maybe people are also overlooking the points that he's costing himself with things like having such bad starts. Like he's like missing out on huge opportunities. Also, if he stayed ahead, Oscar wouldn't have, you know, Oscar shouldn't have been able to dive bomb him. Well, not dive bomb, but go for that overtake. But equally, Oscar's now watched Lando fumble so many starts. Why should he then have to sit back when the likelihood is that's going to happen anyway?
I think some of them have been Lando by himself, but other times it has been the car hasn't helped too much. I know that when he then goes to upshift, I think it's sort of lagging a bit, or there's a problem there, and that's what's causing him to not sort of accelerate off as quickly as he should be able to. So I think sometimes it's the car, sometimes it's him, and they just haven't been quite able to get sort of that harmonious link up yet, just so that he can lead at lap round turn one and just the whole of lap one.
Every week, McLaren are finding a different thing that's causing a problem with the launches and getting it off the line. I think for me, that's why I'm putting them in as my spinner as well, is the fact that they haven't found the cure to this problem. It's they've sort of worked through the launch systems and the launch parameters and the throttle and the clutch feel. So the initial getaway is great. Then in Zandvoort, we saw the car suffer with wheel spin in the second phase through first gear as it starts to sort of deploy its electrical power and it just overwhelms the rear axle. And then it's sort of, okay, that was enough for Norris to and Piastri to both get fantastic getaways against Charles Leclerc, who's one of the best starters off the line on the grid. They both had a good enough getaway to get down to turn one before Leclerc. The problem then was getting drive out of the turn and the fact that Piastri just was able to get his car squared, get his car turned and get out of that first chicane better than Norris. And equally, if Norris wants to become a world champion, he should be able to do it without not needing his teammate to not attack him. Like you can't, that's like sort of going, oh, go easy on him so he can be a world champion. Let your little brother have a go.
If he spent as much time focusing on improving as he did whining during and after the race, then we wouldn't be having the conversation that we're having. But he has, as you said earlier, Helen, not yet learned this.
Yeah, there is something interesting going on there. But I think the definition of A, they are allowed to race, let them race. You cannot be surprised when they do. And also, if you want him to become a world champion, you need to let him actually race people. You can't just sort of go, oh, Oscar, please don't do this. We want him to be world champion. But we can't do that if you keep proving you're actually a little bit better than him when it comes to going wheel to wheel through really demanding circuits, because that upsets the narrative, which is strange. Anyway, we'll move into our predictions, which, of course, were laid down before the weekend. And there are points to be awarded. Point to be awarded. 1 point for Ellie May for her Lando Norris pole position. No one got points for the podium. No, Ellie May got a point for the podium because she predicted Piastri second. So she got that. So it's 2 points to Ellie May this weekend. No,
my bad.
Yeah, so I went back and checked. Yeah, that's it. Otherwise, points-wise, you and I got none.
That's me in the doghouse.
Yeah. But then, of course, there is the Fantasy F1 review for the Monza weekend. Follow Trackside Hub, 264 points. Noah Honga, 259 points. And what's the racing point? 244. On the curbs came P11, Justica para Carlos, P18, JB Racing, P22, and Jaffa Cake Racing, P37. Verstappen, both Haas drivers, Yuki, Albon, Haas, and Red Bull. Not my strongest layout. I don't think we even cracked much. We didn't even crack triple figures on that one. We were like 34
When I do these, I always try and find the highest of our teams because we've all got multiple teams in here. And the fact that yours was 22nd was the highest one. I thought, oh dear, he has had a steamer of a weekend.
76 points. Get in there, my guys. Overall, take a stroll, 3,336 points. What's the racing point? 3,295 points. Noah Honga, 3,254 points. On the curbs, P12, Mid-Beds Racing, P13. You're just clinging on ahead of me.
Now.
Yeah, Ellie May's podcast team.
I overtook you after last week now. Yeah, I was behind you last week.
Ellie May's podcast team, P20, and the Greatest Moustache, P37. I'm not bitter at all. Anyway, that's all we've got time for on this week's episode. We've been going for about an hour and 20 minutes, and my voice is just about clinging on. In the meantime, Timo, we'll start with you. Where can the people find you?
I'll go for my social media at this point, because everything's through there anyway. So t.elvis.david on the curbs. You can find everything and everything that I do, including a brand new interview I've got out with Italian racing driver and driver coach Daniele Rocchi, which was out today.
Beautiful. Ellie May, where can the people find you?
Firstly, I have one more point in that carbon fibre is obviously king because...
Is this because we didn't let you go on about it in the preview?
Yep. Well, Charles Leclerc and Carlos Sainz had the tribute to carbon fibre as their overalls, didn't they? So
this is true.
How well that turned out.
Yeah.
But you can find me on my Instagram page where I'm taking a little break from the Silverstone Festival posts, as on Saturday I went to Congress of Elegance, so I will be posting about them. I realise I have about 50 photos that I want to get out. I've done about 10, so I think there will be quite a few posts on Concours of Elegance. So
you can post up to 20 at a time now on Instagram. You should be able to blow through those.
I know, but at the same time, It's well, for one of them, one should have been close ups. No, you shouldn't.
No. You don't know, do you?
No.
Well, I'll try to speak then.
Anyway, there's plenty more fantastic content coming out on Ellie Mae's social media feeds. Catherine, if people want more from you, where can they find you?
Mainly over on TikTok at Kath Bruce. I kind of post silly, mainly F1 takes and also F1 Academy. And then over on the Girls Across the Grid website, writing their F1 Academy blog posts, which I like to think are quite insightful and maybe a bit different from other things about F1 Academy that's out there.
As long as it's all hugely Dorian Pound supportive, I'm with that. In the meantime, if you want more from me, you can, of course, find me across the internet as @JesseOnCars on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok, and writing in the meantime for Classic Car Weekly as well. When this goes out, you'll still be able to pick up the last issue, which is a pretty good one. If not, pick up the latest issue, which will be coming out. I can't remember what I've got in it, but it's all sorts of good stuff. And, of course, I'll be at the Goodwood Revival this weekend as well, which has sprung up on me. And I'll be annoying F1 drivers there and taking lots of fantastic photographs and just generally getting in the way of things as usual. Otherwise, we'll be back with a preview of the Azerbaijan Grand Prix in about a week and a bit's time. And yeah, plenty more from us in the meantime. Oh, and Tim and I will be talking all things Formula 3 because, of course, we saw Leonardo Fornaroli taking the title on the final turn of the race this weekend. Somehow we completely negated to talk about all the exciting feeder series stuff, but that is still to come. So make sure you've liked, commented, subscribed, and got notifications turned on to not miss an episode. Thank you very much, and we'll be back for Baku.